This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 422 was produced on April 4th, 2024. I'm Eric Townsend. Bear Traps Report founder Larry McDonald returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss why gold's correlations to treasury rates and the dollar have broken down, the inflation outlook, energy, and much more. Larry also has a new book out just last week, and already it's in the number one position in the finance category on Amazon. We'll cover what's in the book as well. As you've probably already surmised, I'm suffering the worst case of laryngitis of my entire life, and was only just barely able to get through recording the feature interview with Larry McDonald this week. So I'll be leaving the entire post-game segment in Patrick and Nick's able hands this week, and won't be giving my usual report on crude oil inventories. Thanks for your patience, folks. We should be back to our usual format next week.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. The S&P 500 June futures down 79 basis points, trading at 52.66. This is the first pause in the uptrend, but is it the start of a bigger correction? We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post game. The US dollar index down 7 basis points, trading at 104.22, failed to hold a breakout above the February highs. The May WTI crude oil contract up 502 basis points, trading at 85.43. The bull trend continues. We'll take a look at that chart in the post game. The May RBOB gasoline contract up 337 basis points, trading at 276. Another break to new highs with sights on the 2023 highs as a target. The June gold contract up 466 basis points to 2315. Now that the 2300 level's been achieved, will there still be more strength? Copper up 475 basis points, up to 419, approaching the January 2023 highs. Uranium up 51 basis points, trading at 89 even, starting its uptick. But is it the end of this multi-month correction? The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 16 basis points, trading at 435. And the key news to watch this week is Friday's jobs numbers. And next week, we have the inflation numbers, the Bank of Canada and ECB monetary policy statements, and the FOMC meeting minutes. Eric's interview with Larry McDonald is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Larry McDonald, publisher of the Bear Traps Report and author of a brand new book, which is titled How to Listen When Markets Speak. Folks, as you can tell, I'm suffering some laryngitis as we're recording this interview. Please bear with me. Larry, in the last 2 minutes before we went on the air, gold took out the 2300 round number. We're at 2301 as we speak. What's really surprising to me is there's been a very strong inverse correlation between gold and the dollar. And of course, gold's always competing with interest rates. So usually as interest rates go up, gold goes down. We're seeing a change in correlations. What's going on here?
Well, I think the beast in the market, Eric, and first of all, you losing your voice is like, you know, Ted Williams losing the bat is in the batting box. But you've done such a marvelous job over the years leading this incredible program of Micro Voices. Thank you for everything and all your leadership and the whole team. But I would say that with gold, the beast in the market inside knows the gig is up. Politically, the Fed can't really hike. If they were to hike because of, you know, inflation expectations, then it's going to blow up the regional banks. And essentially, the beast of the market knows that the Fed really can't do much. And so normally in the last couple of years, if interest rates went up, gold was lower. And now over the last couple of weeks, especially today and yesterday, gold is moving higher with rates. And it's almost like we're going back to the 1970s dynamic where there's a stagflation probability that's rising and Washington is really in trouble with that $80 billion a month of interest now, and that it's going to go up to maybe $80 billion a month, to potentially annually $1.4 trillion of annual interest costs over the next year if the Fed hikes or keeps rates here. So the beast in the market knows that the Fed politically is dealing with a troubled Washington, really a spoiled brat. And I think that's what gold's telling us.
We're also seeing oil catching a bid. Now, early in this Gaza conflict, I was very outspoken in saying I thought that the Gaza conflict was really going to push risk in the oil market much higher. A lot of people who are more experienced than me in the oil market said, no, not in this case. It's not going to happen. Is that what's now starting to happen, or is it something else that's causing oil to catch a bid suddenly?
Well, see, that gets back to the whole stagflation problem, because if the economy, you know, the Fed's potentially cutting rates for a reason, right? We're slowing down to a whole bunch of reasons why the Fed wants to cut rates politically. But if oil rips here, say $20, and the amount of commercial real estate on the bank balance sheets is substantial, is very interest rate sensitive. So we're also seeing a relationship between interest rates, oil, and the banks. And that's picking up with intensity. And so we run a Bloomberg chat with our clients are typically hedge funds, mutual funds, and pension funds. In the last 3 weeks or 2 weeks, a lot of clients are talking about this interest rate sensitivity with the regional banks. And so the higher oil goes, say oil goes up $20 because of a geopolitical event, which is happening. We've already had one this week. We're up a couple of dollars, but we're at a threatening level. If oil were to rip higher, that puts substantial pressure on the banks because of all that commercial real estate exposure. Oil up puts pressure on rates. All of a sudden, it potentially brings hikes into the picture, but the Fed can't hike at this point in the cycle. And that's really is putting a lot of pressure on the super regional banks. They're on some of these super regionals, Eric, are underperforming the S&P by 40 to 50% over the last, say, since a year ago, January. And that's something you only see in a financial crisis.
You mentioned that there were several reasons that the Fed was unable to cut rates or wanting to cut rates, but maybe having more difficulty than they expected. Let's go a little deeper on that. What do you see on the horizon in terms of inflation? Would you agree with Jim Bianco's view that we may have already bottomed on inflation? Is that part of this? And what is tying the Fed's hands here?
Yes, the global economy is in a better spot. So if you look at Japanese equities, and if you look at Italian equities or French equities, those markets have been at near all-time highs in the last couple of months. The European banks on the RSI week daily level are the most overbought in 10 years by a big factor. So there's something going on there on the global side. So in other words, we're getting a surprise on the global economy. China had a better data this week on the manufacturing side. So we're getting a surprise there. Surprise demand. Oil markets are very tight seasonally. You got a summer driving season coming in. And essentially, we're getting this upward pressure on commodity prices, very stagflationary. The U.S. economy, the bottom 60% of Americans are really hurting. You can look at data from pet care. You look at data from McDonald's. You got Dave and Buster's tonight, missed. So the bottom 60% of Americans, you know, the New York Fed has told us many times, Eric, that the bottom, say, 30, 40% of Americans only have $400 in their checking account. The New York Fed has lectured us on that over and over again. So it's like two economies. One economy is in trouble, whereas the top 20% are doing just fine. But politically, in an election year, with that bottom 60% in that much pain with interest rates and all of those additional costs of oil, it's very difficult for the Fed. The political pressure to cut rates into that environment is extremely high, and that sets up a real what we talk about in our book, When Markets Speak, we're talking about a colossal migration of capital. And this is one of the most incredible opportunities in markets in our lifetimes.
The S&P 500 has finally traded below its 13-day moving average just on Tuesday for the first time. And just looking at my chart here, it looks like several weeks. Is this finally the beginning of a correction lower, or is this just noise?
Well, think about this, Eric. So in 2024, you've got oil and gas equities up 16%. Copper equities are up 15%. Gold is up 10%, right? Uranium equities up about 9%. The S&P's up 9%, and the super wonder kid, big tech is up 8%. So essentially, oil and gas is in 2024 is doubling the performance of the NASDAQ 100. I mean, that is just mind blowing if you just think about listening to the media. So this trade where capital is starting to move into other asset classes away from that crowded trade.
Larry, the Magnificent Seven stocks, of course, have been the story for years and years, it seems. Is that story finally winding down? Is that what we're seeing here? And if so, where is that capital going to go if that trend is ending?
Well, we're hearing, Eric, from professional investors that we talk to, the biggest stat is that think of NVIDIA at $2.3 trillion valuation, worth almost as much as the entire energy sector. But as a percentage of the S&P, NVIDIA is up to almost 5%. It's about 5% of the S&P, whereas the energy sector is about 3% of the S&P. So in other words, you've got the crowding of these ideas. If you look at the NASDAQ 100, close to $22 trillion in the NASDAQ 100 in the first quarter, $22 trillion in the NASDAQ 100. Say 10 years ago, the NASDAQ 100 and the energy sector were about the same size, right? Today, the NASDAQ 100 is $18 trillion larger. And this is just one of the most crowded trades of all time. The AI, artificial intelligence dynamic, has sucked in a lot of hot money. Reminds me of the 90s. In the 90s, we created convertbond.com. We were fortunate enough. It was the trade of my lifetime. We sold it to Morgan Stanley. And in the 90s, Eric, what everybody was focused on was the Lucents, the Global Crossings, the Ciscos, the JDS Unifaces. And so when a revolutionary, game-changing technology comes on the scene, people focus their eyes and minds on these, showcase trades, these high-profile trades. And at the end of the day, what happened in the 90s, I think, is about to happen now, where it's those second, third level trades. Like after the 90s, we had Match.com and we had Meta, we had Google, and all these companies that harnessed the incredible power of the internet. And it's just like artificial intelligence today. Natural gas is probably going to be one of the most powerful winners here. Energy, just energy sources and just the power grid alone. You're talking about copper. We're talking about a 50-year-old power grid in the United States, 50 years old in some spots, 30 years old in others. You're talking about we need to supply the energy source for artificial intelligence. In 2022, it was about 460 terawatt hours. But if you believe NVIDIA and all these great salespeople that are telling us about the potential of artificial intelligence, it could be in, say, 2026, 27, 28, upwards of 2,000 terawatt hours, which is equivalent of the amount of demand of electricity and power of Germany and France. And so we have a world where we've suppressed the supply of energy and natural gas because of all these things, ESG and all these regulations. We're suppressing the supply and the demand is about to explode. And so there's this incredible distance, this incredible spread between supply and demand that's looking out, say, 18 to 24 months. We're talking about a major energy crisis that's coming upon us.
Well, you and I agree very much on that, but I have to admit that what I've gotten wrong several times in my career is the timing of that energy crisis. When do you think we get to the rubber meets the road point where we see that divergence between supply and demand that just forces prices much higher, regardless of policy decisions?
If you think of the COVID world and emerging markets and emerging market economies, we've taken 5 million jobs out of the United States over the last 20 years. We've moved them into India, Bangladesh, China, all these emerging market countries. We've decimated the Rust Belt, which has had a major impact on elections. The Biden team wants to reshore jobs. So does the Trump administration. But a lot of these jobs have been pushed around the world. And what we can see very clearly is the energy demand, whether it be mopeds coming from India in the fourth quarter, there's a billion people in India that don't have air conditioning. So when you raise the standard of living of people around the world dramatically, because we did this globalist march, right? And so we're raising that standard of living among consumers, young consumers in emerging market countries, in that consumption. And that's why you're seeing the India stock market is literally been one of the most best performing stock markets in the world. And so we're definitely having this demand surge from around the world, you know, from developing market countries, from Northern Africa, from African countries, from emerging markets, even from Europe. But the supply, because of all the regulatory overhang in the United States, the supply of, say, natural gas, LNG, we can't get it fast enough to market. And there's just that, I think it's very certain that that spread is developing. And then, you know, if you look at it from a trader perspective, if you look at the curve in terms of backwardation, we've got into a backwardation. That's with the front month on the oil contracts is more expensive than the outer. So there's a lot of evidence that the seasonality with oil and gas and all of that, you know, short-term trading in a one-year view, I think extremely bullish. And so I know it's very hard to time it right, but looking out, you know, 1, 2, 3 years, 4 years, I think we have a really outstanding trade in natural gas, oil, and uranium, and all these metals that are supposed to really complete our power grid. Our power grid is a $2 trillion hole, essentially. We're at a $2 trillion hole to improve the power grid, to make that power grid capable of handling all the electric vehicles, all that artificial intelligence. And at the same time, if you think about metals, I mean, for the love of God, we're going to have one of the things that institutional investors are talking to our team about every day is the Ukraine rebuild, right? And that's going to be tough to really time, but that's something that like 2-3 years from now, we're going to be trying to rebuild the Ukraine, all that demand for the copper and aluminum. At the same time, we have this artificial intelligence revolution with electric vehicles and in countries like India that are growing, if their energy consumption at, you know, 3 to 4 times the developed world, it's just there's just no question that we have this energy crisis upcoming upon us.
Larry, one of the themes that we've been discussing with several of our guests is the shift from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. It really feels to me like this conflict with Ukraine is not ending. I think that the conflict, the real conflict, is between the United States, Russia, and China. I think Ukraine has mostly been a proxy in that. And regardless of how the Ukraine thing works out, I think we're just getting started in this shift. What would that mean for markets? How does it change the landscape in terms of how portfolios have to be designed? What are the consequences? And I guess I should start with, do you agree that we're moving very much toward a multipolar world? And this is a big trend that doesn't end with the Ukraine conflict.
Absolutely. And it's a huge part of our book, When Markets Speak, around that transition. And if you think about the whole world and think about the investment community and you think about asset classes and passive investing, everybody is essentially in a 2010 to 2020 portfolio. Everybody's long the same stocks. Everybody's long really a disinflationary portfolio, a unipolar world portfolio. And that's the type of world we were in for a long period of time. A unipolar world is a world where supply chains are working brilliantly, where there's one major power of the world, there's less global conflicts. But a multipolar world is like a 1960s to 1980 world where there are more global conflicts. But today, Eric, today, It's like literally watching the Terminator. We have drone attacks that are in the last month that are taking out ships in the Suez Canal, or they're taking out refineries in Russia. I mean, for the love of God, if Putin, in all his advanced technology, can't protect the Russian refineries, and that's one of the reasons why we've had this big move up in oil in recent days and weeks, because of this multipolar world, these strikes on these refineries. If they can't protect those assets, if one attack on the Saudi oil fields gets through, then we're in a real 1970s, 1980s problem, because the market's tight enough. We've got global demand. We're underinvested. The biggest point we make in the book, the most important point for our listeners, comes down to this one part of the book. So if you think about 2010 to 2014 and the investments in oil and gas and metals, everything we needed for the world to supply all that energy and all those key commodities, that investment plane from 2010 to 2014, if you moved it forward to today, we're essentially in a $3 trillion hole, a $3 trillion hole. And at the same time, the global population from 2014 to 2024 is up almost a billion people, 1 billion. So we're massively underinvested in a what we call a multipolar world with all kinds of potential problems in the Middle East that have been developing through this whole year. And so every time there's any kind of an attack, the market's tight enough that it creates this real stress. In terms of higher oil prices, that puts stress on the banks, that puts stress on the U.S. consumer. In an election year, the one thing we've been hearing, Eric, from institutional clients in the last month is if Putin wants to influence the U.S. election, the easiest weapon in the world for him to use is take down oil production with the Saudis. And that's what, if you look behind the scenes at a lot of the data, there's no question that he's doing that. And so when you come into a seasonal period with the summer driving season in the United States, lots of demand, typically a very bullish period for oil. And if Putin does cut back production, remember these guys, Russia produces like 9 to 10 million barrels a day. In some years, maybe 11 million barrels a day. So it's a major major global producer. In an election year, this is the big wild card. If Putin wants to influence that U.S. election, all he has to do is join the Saudis and cut back production even more. And then we have a real big election wild card in November 2024.
You said earlier that if one attack on a Saudi oil field got through, that could really change the game. Do you perceive a risk of an attack on Saudi oil fields? And if so, from whom?
Well, that's where it gets into. That's why I said the Terminator, because we're in a period where if you create enough drones with the better technology, and if you have that better technology can get through the counter forces, you know, those Patriot missiles or the missile defense systems, it's really an incredible battle. Now, granted, when you talk to institutional investors, they'll tell you that the Saudi oil fields have much greater protection than, say, those refineries in Russia or, you know, parts of the canal, the Suez Canal. So there's reasons why there have been attacks on the canal in multiple spots, multiple ships, and multiple refineries in Russia. Those areas are not as well protected. But it's really like a scene out of the Terminator where Arnold Schwarzenegger and James Cameron, you know, what an incredible movie where those technologies and all it takes is one to get through. It's still, you know, not a high probability, but if you just think about the last couple of months, we've gone from a problem in Israel, a tragedy. Then we now obviously the entire developed world can't protect one of the major canals in the world. That's a classic multipolar situation. And then we've gone to refineries being struck in Russia by, I guess, Ukrainian drones. And so it's just escalating to the point where it's like, where does this go next? And it's very clear to us that it's a multipolar world with a lot of tension. And the strike this week with Israel, you know, on that embassy in the Middle East, an Iranian embassy, that's clearly another escalation. So it looks like we're just going to have another path forward of more escalation until there's a solution that's going to put more pressure on oil, more pressure on rates, more pressure on the regional banks, and more pressure on the U.S. consumer in election year.
Larry, I always enjoy our conversations because, like myself, you're a big picture thinker and you're really seeing all of the different facets of this. But let's try to take this whole conversation now and bring it back to the trades that we can actually put on in a portfolio. We've talked about a number of subjects in this interview already, from artificial intelligence to the energy transition, the metals that are going to be needed for that, to what's going on with energy. Obviously, you want to be buying commodities in backwardation wherever you can. I agree with you that there's probably a lot of upside for natural gas, but that's a tough commodity to be on the long side of. So, you know, do you trade that through the equities? Let's just take all of this and try to frame it in terms of where the trades are.
Well, what we've been looking at is, okay, value stocks that can benefit from the rebuild of the power grid in the United States, or all this, like I said before, earlier in the interview, artificial intelligence, the best trade is probably in the natural gas space. Companies that are going to benefit from this incredible explosion in demand for electricity and energy over the next couple of years. And then you've talked about, everybody knows the LNG export trade, which Europe wants to replace Russia, right? So there's a lot of incredible demand there. That hasn't worked out because these LNG facilities haven't come online fast enough, and there's been, you know, a warm winter in Europe. So the bottom line is you've got a trade here in natural gas companies that is powered by both this explosion in artificial intelligence and data centers, and then this explosion in LNG demand that's coming from Europe that's massively politically driven. So if you look at Antero Resources, I mean, here's some an amazing stats on Antero. So it's a $9 billion market cap company. We think they're going to do $1 billion of free cash flow in 2025. So it's 11% free cash flow yield, 11% free cash flow yield. And Antero's been buying back. And this is the fascinating part. These companies are producing cash. They've been buying back $1 billion of stock in over the last year or so, a little bit more. So they've bought back almost 10%, 10, 15% of the outstanding shares. You know, one thing about this commodity cycle, these balance sheets are much less levered than in cycles past. They have only $4 billion of debt versus equity market cap of $9 billion. So you look at a stock like that, and you talk about, if you really believe NVIDIA and you really believe in this whole LNG export dynamic and all these data centers and all this demand, you're talking about natural gas prices that are going to be most likely in the $6 to $8 range relative to below two now. And I'm talking in the next, you know, 2-3 years. And companies like Antero that are, you know, on the pace to produce 11% free cash flow yield, I just see like a tremendous, like your risk reward. You potentially have, you know, it's with some of these stocks, you get 5 to 10 baggers on the upside. And, you know, you do have some downside, 20 to 30% if things don't work out. But the upside, you know, you're talking about 5, 10, 20 baggers with some of these names in the natural gas space.
Larry, you mentioned the power grid. Let's go a little deeper on that.
Well, I mean, if you believe the analysts on Wall Street, and analysts love to upgrade stocks on the highs. I mean, the analysts were crickets a year ago in the first quarter. They barely mentioned this artificial intelligence dynamic in last January, February, and everybody was downgrading a lot of these stocks. But, you know, now the analysts are putting up very incredibly rosy projections for companies like NVIDIA and data center demand and artificial intelligence. And if you think about all of that electricity demand over the next couple of years coming on an aging power grid that's 30 years old in some spots, 50 years old in others, and then you think about the projections on electric vehicles, all of those vehicles coming on, and hybrids and alike, but a lot of stress on the power grid. Companies like Generac that make backup generators in states like Texas, those are solutions for hiccups along the way. And so whenever you see these big secular cycle trades, the media makes it look like we're going to have a straight doorstep to this, you know, new nirvana. But there's a lot of times there's tremendous hiccups along the way. And you got to think, okay, the power grid's one. And if the power grid breaks down as it did in Texas in recent years, you know, your Generacs of the world are going to benefit. And then the metals themselves, like copper, you've got political crisis in Panama over the last year that has been suppressing copper supply. Same thing in Chile and Peru. Panama, Chile, and Peru are tremendous copper producers. The supply of copper relative to demand has been kind of under arrest. And so copper itself as a commodity, I talked to an institutional investor this week who's a billionaire, great client of ours. And he's like, Larry, I just want to own the commodity. I just want to own copper. And you can do that a lot of different ways, with a lot of different instruments. But if copper gets too expensive over the next, you know, say 3 to 5 years, aluminum is an incredible commodity. Alcoa today reached about 60% off of the lows. In the fourth quarter, the street was aggressively downgrading Alcoa. Alcoa's got one of the best, obviously, aluminum producers in the world. And so aluminum is a very a potential solution to expensive copper prices if you look at the build out of the power grid. And like I said, that's a $2 trillion problem. But the only way you're going to get all those electric vehicles and all of that artificial intelligence, those data centers up and running, is through these second and third level trades in aluminum, in copper, and things like Generac.
Larry, in this global multipolar world that we're talking about, China is obviously one of the most important players. Let's start with your outlook on how U.S.-China relations go, but then what are the consequences of that in markets?
Well, what's interesting, Eric, is that in the first quarter, there was this big move toward ownership of equities in Japan, equities in India. And a lot of the momentum players were short China and long India and Japan. And in the second quarter, today we had President Biden had a phone call with President Xi. And there's no question that the pressure on China now, from what I hear from all of our top consultants, China equities are the most under-owned that they've been in a decade in terms of the global position in portfolio structure. And so China has been through this, obviously, these lockdowns over the last 2-3 years. They've had the property crisis. And so if you're China, you want to try to increase incentives on equity ownership because they had a property crisis. Think about the United States. When we had the property crisis in the, say, 2008, what did the Fed do? They kind of emphasized or kind of steered people toward taking down real estate exposure and increasing equity exposure. That's what the big central planners do. And that's what we think they're going to do in China. And then if you think of like ownership of equities and how cheap these companies are, at one point within the last year, you could fit 14 Babas in Apple. And so when you talk to professional investors that for decades that have been managing portfolios around China, I talked to a really interesting guy last week and he said, you know, they used to go over to Europe. They used to be in the conference rooms and they would run out of coffee. They would run out of bagels. They would run out of muffins because, you know, they're standing room only. And he said, you know, over the last 6 months, when he goes on the same trips, there's nobody in the room. And so after this whole threat around all the threats from Russia with the war in the Ukraine and all that, everybody took down their exposure to Russian equities because of the tragedy there. And the next level of divesting came into China and everybody is divested from China. Not everybody, but there aren't many people that own these equities. They're extremely cheap. It's still a $14 billion economy. And most of all, if once the Fed starts easing, then China can ease in a more forceful manner. If China can't do it without the Fed, because if China starts to ease without the Fed, it weakens the Chinese yuan, the currency, and it creates all kinds of problems internationally. And so if the Fed over the next year, you know, if a year, 12 months, starts to cut rates, that's going to be extremely bullish for China.
The U.S. is extremely dependent on China for everything from pharmaceuticals. We get a lot of our drugs from China. We depend on a lot of things that, you know, tech items and so forth that are manufactured in China. And I think there's a lot of complacency in the marketplace and the assumption that, oh, you know, the Chinese need the income from exports to the United States. They would never dare to cut us off from those critical things that we need, even in a really tense geopolitical conflict, because they can't afford to. I'm not so persuaded of that, Larry. Now, if it turned out that that view was wrong and China really was inclined to embargo some exports of things like rare earths and cobalt, what could that mean? Do you think it's a plausible scenario? And if so, what would it mean for markets, and how much turmoil would it create for the U.S. economy if they were to strategically cut us off from a few things in order to push a point in a geopolitical negotiation?
Yeah, so this is a big part of our book, When Markets Speak, where we talk about geopolitically in the most dangerous position that the United States is in, because when you're a dictatorship, whether it be Russia or China, they've been able to think about hard assets versus financial assets. The U.S. is essentially long lots of financial assets, lots of stocks, paper, securities, and lots of bonds. And a lot of that wealth is in paper assets, financial assets. Whereas if you look at the last 5 years, 10 years, and 15 years, if you look at Russia, these countries have been loading up and backing up the truck on all kinds of hard assets. We mean, you know, whether it be rare earths, cobalt. So think about this. One stat from the book is China controls 75% of cobalt. I mean, think of the iPhones, and think of everything, and lithium and everything you need for cobalt, and they control about 82% of rare earths. And so if you think about rare earths, we need them for wind farms, we need them for car batteries and electrical energy. And so we have this incredible sales pitch from all of Wall Street and all of Washington around the Green Revolution and windmills and solar panels. But when you look behind the scenes, the emperor has no clothes in terms of those key strategic metals that will be needed to supply all of our green meadow and produce that green meadow to get us to that promised land, to that carbon neutral 2050. A lot of those strategic metals and key metals are controlled by Russia and China, especially China. And if you think about, okay, if the world flips, this is a kind of one of the lines from the book, but if the world flips from fossil fuels to solar, let's just say we want to flip tomorrow or the next 5 years from fossil fuels to solar, you would need a solar field as big as France. That's about 150 million acres and more plastic than there is on the planet. I mean, miles and miles of cables. And so the amount of materials and strategic metals and rare earths to get us to that promised meadow and that promised land of carbon neutral 2050 is just mind-blowing, and nobody's doing the math. And so I think you want to look at companies like MP Materials or companies like Hecla Mining in the silver space and MP Materials in the rare earths, companies that produce metals that are in what we call geographically safer communities or that have less jurisdictional risk. As my friend Adrian Day, the famous metals analyst, always says, less jurisdictional risk. And so that's companies that own lots of assets in Canada, in the United States, where those assets are more secure, and those investments in those areas, I think will start to develop a premium in the coming years.
Larry, you've mentioned several topics that are covered in your new book, which is titled How to Listen When Markets Speak. It's currently number one on Amazon in the finance category, and it is available for shipment now. It's not just a pre-order. So it's the book just hit the streets last week. Tell us a little bit more about it, why this particular title, what is the theme of the book, and beyond what you've already said about some of the trades, what can people expect to learn when they read it?
You know, words that I live by, go back to Zig Ziglar. I mean, this goes back to coming out of high school and college, but I really believe that you can get everything in life that you want if you just help enough other people get what they want. You can get everything in life that you want if you help enough other people get what they want. And so when my first book came out, it was about the Lehman crisis. It was a New York Times bestseller. We did 140 speeches in 16 countries. And the best part is I met a lot of great investors. I had meetings with Charlie Munger in Omaha, had meetings with David Tepper in his office, the famous investor at Appaloosa. David Einhorn. And so all of those people and many others are in this book. Mark Cuban's been incredibly valuable mentor of mine. I just have so much gratitude. And so what we've done is we've built up a group of institutional clients and advisors at the Bear Traps Report, and that's our company. And then we've kind of like, let's give back. Let's democratize the information. So let's take everything we've learned over the last 10 years from the institutional investors about how Wall Street really works behind the scenes, and let's democratize that information. Let's bring that information to the smaller investors. And that's what When Markets Speak is all about.
Well, Larry, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and how they can contact you.
Well, I think the two best areas, our website is thebeartrapsreport.com. We work with family offices, financial advisors, high net worth individuals, hedge funds and mutual funds and pension funds. And on Twitter, I'm at ConvertBond. And over the years, I'm really proud of the relationship we built with the Twitter and the X community. And those are two great spots to catch up with us. And we really appreciate all the support for the book.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and hopefully my voice will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Oh, it was great to have Larry back on the show for an update. Now, Eric will be sitting out this post-game segment, so Nick Galarnik and I are going to get straight to the chart deck here. Listeners, you're going to find a download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Larry's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, I want to just start off with the crude oil chart here, Nick. And it's been a really good run. I've more or less been bullishly siding with the trend because the price action has been accumulative. It's been staying above its 50-day moving average and working higher. The key is that we actually now have beat Fibonacci retracement zones from the 2023 market correction. And so at this stage, I'm really curious whether the bulls will be able to get this back up to the highs that we both saw in November of 2022 and in September 2023, especially in light of escalating geopolitical tensions. Maybe a little bit of oil premium might be coming in here.
Well, that's just it, right? I mean, you look at the Fed and their decision-making right now, and a lot of it is predicated upon inflation. If we get energy prices skyrocketing again, that's going to make it very hard for them to cut rates, and it's going to actually guide markets probably lower in the shorter term, which leads us to the discussion on the S&P.
All right. Well, let's jump straight to it. Let's first start off with you giving the levels. What are the levels on the S&P?
So right now we have a spot price of approximately 5210 on SPX. We have an implied move for the April 19th monthly OPEX, plus minus 110 points, which gives us an upper implied move of 5320 and a lower implied move of 5100. So right now, what I'm seeing is that we're seeing a lot of consolidation in this area, perhaps a pause overall, but the last 3 days or so have kind of given me a little bit of jitters, or so to speak, in terms of staying long in the market. And I mean long in terms of the short-term positioning, not my long-term positions. Because oftentimes before a larger correction, we see these kind of downward cycle moves. And with the Fed members yesterday discussing possibly only one cut this year, going from, you know, four initially to now one cut, that's a big change in the overall theme that a lot of market participants were expecting.
Yeah. So on page four, I have that S&P 500 chart. Normally, I show the yellow 50-day moving average. But in this case, I put the 20-day moving average on here because it really has contained almost every short-term correction the S&P has had. More importantly, going back to the start of the year, there's been this upwards channel in the S&P 500 drawn between those red lines that has defined that escalator ride high that these markets have been systematically doing. What's really interesting is now these trend lines and moving averages are just sitting north of 5,200, which is not far from where the low from yesterday came in. And so what will be interesting to see is whether or not the bulls do what they have successfully been doing, all year, which is they buy this dip and they work it to the top of the channel. The way it's interesting that, Nick, that we're going into the jobs numbers tomorrow, and the jobs have not played a big role in creating market volatility in the last half year. But it's interesting that we're at this key pivot moment right along a very key support line at the moment when a relatively important news release or economic release is coming out. It'd be interesting to see whether Friday brings about some volatility that breaks any of those downside support lines. Right now, though, the bulls are in control. And while certainly that first day of selling has created a little bit of nervousness, by no means are the bulls in trouble yet. But at some point when this trend line breaks, a proper 300 to 500 S&P point mean reversion will get started. And it's really just now the solving the puzzle piece as to whether this is the point where that turn is happening.
That makes a lot of sense to me, actually, because when you look back to last year, when we finished the year up 23%, we had two instances of the market correcting by about 10%. So we're already in April right now. If we predict that we're going to finish the year up around 15-20% this year, despite this nice bull run, we should expect some pullbacks at some point. Right, like we're not going to shoot straight up nonstop. So what you mentioned about the 300 to 500 point correction makes a lot of sense because that's about 10% or so to the downside. So again, I'm always very cautious about this because it's when you have those pullbacks where the greatest opportunity resides, right? You get those insane opportunities where, you know, certain names that should not be beaten down get beaten down because of broad market pullbacks. That's where you get those awesome opportunities to go long.
All right, well, let's move on to the NASDAQ because I actually have some comments here, but let's start off with just the levels.
So right now in the queues, we have a spot price of approximately 443. We have an implied move for the April 19th monthly OPEX of plus minus 11 points. That gives us an upper implied move of 454 and a lower implied move of 433. As I mentioned in previous weeks, I'm bullish on certain names, namely Google, Apple right now. Google's done very, very well the past few weeks since I caught that bottom around 132 or so. It's up at around 155. Apple is still sitting around support area at 169 or so. But short term, I see those two names being strong. Meanwhile, we're seeing names like Tesla roll over. They had poor sales numbers earlier this week. And it's possible we see Tesla roll over to 150 or so area. I do like Tesla in the long term for reasons I won't get into, but in the short term, I think it could pull back down to 150 or so.
Well, you know, when we look on page 6, and I have the NASDAQ futures chart on there, the interesting thing that we're seeing is that there clearly is evidence of a sector rotation. And while certainly Google had a nice good run on the upside in the last little bit, it's also countered by the fact that NVIDIA has more or less been correcting for now 6-7 days. And the buy on dip traders that normally would come in at these levels have at least not at this moment showed up. But the interesting part here when we look at this chart is that really the NASDAQ has not participated on the upside at all in the last month. It really has been an S&P 500 rally and the NASDAQ has been flat. And you can really see that, Nick, when we go to page 7 and look at the breadth of the market. And what I have is the breadth of the market. On the left, we have the NASDAQ and on the right, the S&P. And what you can see is that we have a breadth based upon the percentage of stocks above their 50-day moving average on the NASDAQ of 42%. Even during this entire month of March, when there's been this big rally, it barely could get above 50% of stocks on the NASDAQ above their averages, which basically is showing that there's a pretty distinct distribution in that NASDAQ basket. At the same time, that S&P 500 got up to 85%. And that really was a broadening of the market, particularly a few sectors like energy. And that's where on page 8, I am showing the sector performance for the 1 month. And you can see the energy sector up 11%, communications up 8%, basic materials up 6%, even utilities up 4%. And yet those areas like consumer defensive, consumer cyclical, and technology, including real estate, have actually all been distributing. And so that sector rotation has really been the name of the game here. And the question here is that can the market have another significant move higher when the distribution in the NASDAQ continues?
Yeah, Patrick. So looking at the communication services in particular, that sector to me is more of a tech basket. Because if you look at the holdings in that, you see that Meta and Google are the top two holdings in a lot of communication services ETFs. So right now, that to me is more of a tech performance. So we're seeing energy and tech outperform handily, basic materials obviously as well. And then we're seeing tech not really so broad, as you mentioned, because a lot of this is selective choosing of names like, you know, Apple, Google, Amazon, Meta, as well as NVIDIA.
All right, Nick, let's get on to that volatility index. We've finally seen a little bit of a spike, but I mean, nothing to write home about. I mean, we're at the 14 handle, still within the range that we have seen all year. We bounced around from, you know, the mid 12 range on the VIX, always got up to like towards 15 and then right back down. What are the current levels on the VIX telling you?
So right now with the VIX sitting at approximately 13, that tells us that we should see intraday top to bottom moves of about 0.75% roughly. And we're seeing these implied ranges stick for the most part each and every day. So what I'm tracking is, for example, around noonish each day, if I notice that the implied range exceeds the current range of top to bottom for a given day, that tells me that we should see some activity into that close, which has happened the last few days. We've had these violent runs up or down, mostly to the downside, where we dropped 20 points in the last hour, for example, which happened yesterday. So tracking the VIX right now is not really so useful for short-term movements. In the longer term, what I'm seeing is that insurance is still very cheap. And if you want to hedge your portfolios, it makes a lot of sense to purchase insurance longer term, perhaps using spreads, because spreads are going to be your friend and you're going to offer, you know, incredible asymmetry of risk where you can, you know, for example, risk $1 to make $9.
So, Nick, I want to move on and talk about commodities, but I really wanted to step back and look at them on weekly charts in the real big picture and just to see what kind of major trends could potentially be getting underway. And I thought the best way to start is to look at that Bloomberg Commodity Index on a weekly chart basis. And you can see that epic bull run in 2021 and into the start of 2022. But we've now been in about a two-year correction in the commodity basket. It's been consolidating off of its highs. But in the last couple of weeks, we have seen that commodity index actually attempting to break out. And we obviously have not beat the third and fourth quarter highs of last year, but it's certainly an uptick that is worth watching. There's still a lot of commodities that are not participating, such as grains and other types of soft commodities. But at the same time, the fact that energy has turned up is a real big plus for this. And it'll be interesting to see whether that actually creates any further follow through. So on page 11, I have the gold chart. And this is again the weekly chart, and all of those major highs in 2020 and 2022 and 2023 that all happened around the 2000 level, we've now definitively and decisively broken out of that range in a very bullish manner. Now, a lot of technicians are very quick to point out some of the measured moves of the 2700 as reasonable targets. But right now, this 2300 was actually a very key target. And this is actually a natural place for gold to pause and consolidate the breakout. To me, that's not bearish. In fact, if gold here pulled back $100+ towards 2200, but decisively stayed above the 2000 level, it would just offer a compelling buy on dip for a continuation pattern. But right now, on the very short term, I'm not as optimistic that this just goes in a straight line to 2700, but it remains very bullish.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Like, I've been holding gold for the past 10 years or so, physical especially, and watching this long base form, you know, the saying, the longer the base, the harder the move up. So right now, what I'm looking for is a break toward 2,500 or so. And I do see a very, very strong move toward 5,000 an ounce in the next few years after this long, long base.
It's interesting in terms of that kind of a target. Like when we look at silver on page 12, this is actually a really interesting chart to me because I wanted to capture more than a decade because I wanted to go back and look at that silver bubble that happened in 2010 to 2011. It was just a melt up in silver where it went from the teens all the way towards $50 an ounce. And since then, there was this prolonged period of consolidation. Now, back in the 2020s has seen a bullish breakout and consolidation for 3 years of silver sideways. And we're now approaching once again the highs of that last 3-4 years. It would be incredibly technically significant if silver was able to break out of this area to confirm that the precious metals markets are running. I don't have a chart on it for platinum and palladium, but they've really not participated at all yet. But silver might be the first precious metal outside of gold to really confirm a new bull breakout.
Yeah, with silver, you have a lot of industrial applications for it. So for example, right now, approximately 56% of its supply is used in industry, whereas for gold, it's about 12% or so. So it makes sense that if we're using silver for actual applications, it would have a nice run as well, right? I think a target of around 30 or so in the short term would make a lot of sense. But moving on to page 13, we have this copper chart. Patrick, what are you thinking over here?
Nick, copper's been in a consolidation for 2 years, no different than that commodity index we talked about earlier. And similar to the chart trying to break out there, we're now approaching the 2023 highs, and a lot of people are getting excited about the short-term upside of copper. I think that as we approach this 430, we're going to get a really important tell. Typically, when we test an area like this is where the market pauses and mean reverts and corrects. Long as old dips are being bought and the price action stays accumulative, it'll be interesting to see whether the bulls can put together a further run up toward $4.75 or even $5 going into the year end. I overall remain quite bullish commodities in general. I just am trying to decipher whether or not it should be as immediately bullish here in the second quarter of the year, or really whether it's something that is a fourth quarter of the year going into next year kind of story. Right now, we're going to get a lot of information about whether or not these follow through when looking at that. Finally, Nick, I wanted to just touch on these uranium charts. And with this uranium, we haven't seen it clear any major hurdles. Like for me, with the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, I was looking for it to get above 30. For the U308, I wanted to see it clearing that 90 to 93 level area. We just haven't seen the physical uranium get any traction on the upside yet. But what I'm curious about is whether or not the uranium stocks are signaling something, because on page 15, I have the Global X Uranium ETF. In the last week, we have seen a legitimate bullish breakout of uranium miners, and they have now shot right back up towards year highs. And curious whether or not the investors are sniffing out that another up leg in uranium may be starting that hasn't yet reflected in spot prices. We saw that similar thing happen in copper, where the copper miners have been running for a month before the copper commodity actually broke out. So it's certainly something to watch.
Folks, if you enjoyed Patrick's chart deck, you can find them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. Just go to the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what to expect to find in this week's research roundup.
In this week's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview and the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame, including a link to a number of articles that we found really interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's research roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @macrovoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend. That is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening, and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.